Working in the media comes with incredible opportunities. Your days are often fast-paced, you get to speak with remarkable people, and you can make a difference through your words or your voice. But it also comes with its significant struggles, the long hours, the burnout, the stress, and the abuse. Mental health in journalism and the media needs a spotlight shone onto it, particularly in a pandemic, as does the world of social media, a space that many of us spend hours in, but it does have its toxic side. So that's what this Mental Health Awareness Week podcast is all about, shining a spotlight on mental health in the media and social media. Joining myself and Will, we have three special guests. First up, we are joined by The Athletic's Derby County writer, Ryan Conway, who wrote a brilliant personal piece last year about his own experiences with depression. Welcome to the podcast, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
We are also joined by a certain someone who has had the pleasure of working with my good self for the last 3.5 years, but he is now the sports social media editor for The Mirror and The Express. It is Tommy Wathen. Hello, Tommy.
Alistair, thank you for inviting me on.
That's more than okay. And finally, she hasn't been able to join us today as we record this, but through the power of editing, you will hear her later on in the podcast. We are also joined by journalist Rebecca Myers of the Sunday Times. So, hello everyone properly. Lots of topics to cover throughout this episode, and obviously one we can all relate to in one way or another. As long-time listeners of this show will obviously know, Will works in comms for England and GB hockey as his day job, while I'm the digital lead for the Hearts Live news website, my day job. So we've all got something to share along the way. I will start then with Ryan, because I name-checked your piece in October 2020 in the intro, where you opened up about your own experiences. Do you just want to share some of your own story with depression and with anxiety? Because I think it was something you were first diagnosed with at the age of 20.
Yeah. So I really struggled to adapt to life at university. And that was sort of, you know, I remember going to my university doctors in November of whichever year it was, and filled out this questionnaire. I remember just sitting in the doctor's room, and he said, "How can I help?" And I just burst into tears. I just feel sad all of the time. My diet wasn't good. My sleeping wasn't good. Like I said, I didn't adapt to uni life very well. And then I was diagnosed with depression. I had no idea how I was telling my family about that. Was failing uni, ultimately did fail my second year, had to go back and retake it. And I just remember sort of telling my dad, my stepmom and my dad, once I'd failed, that, you know, I'd failed uni, I've got depression, you know, I'm really sorry I've let you all down, and all this sort of stuff. And it was a very, very, very slow climb back to, you know, just a place of normality. And then past uni, and then the second time I was got a bout of depression was because my mum died in 2016. She was only 43, very, very, very unexpected. She had a brain hemorrhage. And then, yeah, that was like just, it was, to be honest with you. It really, really was. You know, there is no manual on how you get through losing a parent. And I sort of went into a very self-destructive cycle for about 6 to 8 months before I sort of went back into counselling and started that process all over again. And then the sort of latest one was September, when I took 3 weeks off, just a short break to kind of recalibrate. I was feeling burnt out from work. I was feeling burnt out from social media. I was feeling worn out, you know, was feeling a little bit vulnerable, a little bit scared, and just had to get away because I could feel those triggers starting to hit again. And that was what prompted me to write the piece in October.
It's very powerful and a lot to digest from that. And it's just interesting. You're able to sort of notice the triggers and things like that. Were a lot of the triggers then coming from work, or were sort of seeing all the things on social media, or was that just one of the many things that you found was weighing on your mind at the time?
So for me, the initial triggers came from social media. I started getting really bad anxiety. And to be honest, I still get anxiety now when I have to log into Twitter, but I have the tools to be able to just take deep breaths. I post what I have to post and I get off the timeline because there are just so many bad experiences, from Twitter, specifically Twitter, because I keep my other social media accounts private. I don't have Facebook anymore, but keep all my other social media accounts private. But Twitter's the one where you think, as a journalist, you're a public figure. And I struggled with that because I was, before this job, I was just Ryan Conway, some random guy with some thoughts. And, the more followers you acquire. And to me, I found it really difficult to compute. Why would you follow me to then give me abuse? Like, why don't you just unfollow me? Like, why? I don't get it. I don't understand it. And all the triggers came from that. And then I became very scared to even do my job. Because I was like, Barry on Twitter is going to hammer me, and I just couldn't take it. And I realized, I was drinking like 2 glasses of red wine a night, and I wasn't, I'm a social drinker, but I wasn't an every night drinker, And I started, and that was a tendency where when I lost my mum, I basically became a borderline alcoholic and didn't even realize it until obviously you're out of that. So I'd be sat there with like my second glass of wine in my hand, and was like, what am I doing? I don't drink this frequently. Why am I drinking this frequently? And it was only 2 glasses, but for me, that was out of the ordinary for me. And it was like, because you're worrying about what's being said about you. You're worrying about, people hammering you about your opinions or your articles or your pieces. You're worrying about, if you've upset this player or this team or this manager or this club. And it just became too much. And it was sort of right. Okay. We need to take a step back from everything, from every last person. I just needed to go away for a little bit.
Was there a moment where you kind of realized that you were in that spiral or something that triggered that moment when you thought, I need to get away from this and I just need to switch off a bit?
Yeah, I actually did. I just walked out of the game at halftime. first game of this season, Carabao Cup derby against Barrow at halftime, and I remember actually being really excited the night before and even that morning. I remember being really excited. Football was back. The turnaround time was quick, but football was back. It gave me a reason to be out and about again. I remember going to the game, and like literally like the minute I left the house, like just fear just consumed me. I remember getting to the game. Didn't say a word to anybody. And normally I say hi to everyone and check how everyone's been doing since last time I saw them and stuff like that. And then I remember sitting, the game starting, wasn't really watching the game, wasn't really engaged in the game, didn't really care what was going on. I remember I just kept looking up at the clock because I'd made the decision. I said, the minute the ref blows his whistle, I'm out of it. I was like, I'm getting out of it. Didn't even tell, my boss until I'd actually got back home, by which time the game was already in like its 70th minute or so by the time I'd got back home. And yeah, that was the point where and I just stopped. Like my minute by minute on Twitter just stopped. Like I didn't tell anyone, sorry folks, not feeling well, going whatever. I just stopped, went home, lay on the sofa for about 2 hours, completely numb. And I just remember ringing my boss and said, I need to go away. I said, I need to go away. I need to go away for a good few weeks. I'd had enough. I'd had enough of the job. I'd had enough of Twitter. I'd had enough. So yeah, I picked myself up, put my laptop in my bag, and just walked out the stadium.
Something you mentioned in a previous answer was, it's quite interesting for me. You mentioned about how that you're the public profile and sort of you're the person that people on social media will turn to sort of have a go at. And it's interesting for me because I can essentially hide behind Great Britain and England hockey. Like no one really knows it's me that does the job unless they listen to the podcast or they're like really, really keen, in which case you might know a little bit about me, but it's very much about GB hockey and the brand and the players. But for you three, you are sort of those public profiles, those public figures, and you do get a lot more abuse, like directed particularly like straight at you. I was just wondering, like, do you ever get training or do you ever sort of get top tips or do you ever get told how to like deal with that? Because it must be so difficult, especially if people, all people are doing is having a go.
Yeah, so work work are really, really good at bringing in like speakers to talk to us about, you know, social media abuse, dealing with social media abuse, how the sort of, they call it the triangle, you know, the social media triangle works, where you're placed in like victim, rescuer, and I can't remember the other one, and how it all, you know, how it all interacts with one another. But even with all the training, even with all the talks, the ignore it, it's still really difficult. You know, I've got all my notifications muted. I recently closed my DMs, but it's still really, really, really difficult. Because I think a lot of it depends on what kind of personality you are. And I'm, you know, admittedly a very emotional person. That's just who I am. So when someone abuses me, my natural instinct is to want to fight, you know, to want to bring the fight to you. Think, all right, because I always think that people think you can say whatever you want behind this keyboard. And I think a lot of people get away with, like, journalists generally just posting their pieces or ignoring it. And sometimes I think that if you want to fight, then we'll fight. And that I'm by no means advocating doing that. But, and I've stopped doing that more recently, as I take a much more withdrawn role from the platform. But that was always my natural reaction, because I thought, well, you don't get to sit there and say whatever you want about me and just expect me to take it, because I might be a journalist, but I'm a human being as well. And that's how I always react. It's very difficult to change that when you've always reacted that way to, you know, they come off the triangle, to withdraw, to ignore it. You know, and I get sort of this coupling effect as well, where I write a lot of pieces on racism. So when you do those pieces, then you get really, really bad abuse from some quarters. And that's when it becomes just unbearably, unbearably difficult, when not only is it abuse, but you sit there and think, some of these people just hate me just because I'm black.
Did you mentioned before we started recording that it was your first job in journalism. Do you think you were prepared for it when you got into it originally? Or is it just something that you've had to get better and better at the more things that have been thrown at you in one way or another?
No, I wasn't prepared for it at all. I was not ready. Because you know, I've done work experience on, you know, sports desks, where I don't even get the byline sometimes. It's just, you know, turn out these 400 words, please, on, you know, whatever the going stories of the day are. Suddenly being asked to, you know, source your own stories, your own contacts, build relationships, I wasn't taught any of that, because that wasn't part of the work experience process. No one at an agency or a news desk was going, you know, can you build all these contacts, please, and write up all these words and have this big public profile. No one was doing that. Like, that's not what work experience is. So I had to learn all of that from the ground up. And the problem I have, and I highlighted this in the piece that I did, the problem I have is, when you start a job as a butcher, banker, mechanic, whatever it is, you know, you start a job, you're allowed to make mistakes because you're learning the job. I had to play my mistakes out in public. So every mistake I was hammered for. You make mistakes in other jobs, you know, your boss might have a word with you, colleague might help you out. Me, I had 6,000 people telling me I wasn't worth a damn. And you think, but I'm new at this. I'm new at all of this. So I'm going to make mistakes. The difference is I'm being forced, because of the nature of my job, to play those mistakes out in front of thousands of people. Like, can you imagine how that feels?
Do you think it's different for you because you're working in football? And I'm thinking, if you were working in another sport, do you think it would be as bad as it is in football? Or do you think just because of the way football is supported and the thousands upon thousands of millions who follow football in this country, do you think that just amplifies it more?
So I remember working in rugby a little bit during university and doing that. And that was a lot easier. That environment was so much nicer. you know, everyone was, and don't get me wrong, you know, this is, you know, sports fans are sports fans. You're always going to have some people who are like that, because a Derby fan, a United fan, a Leeds fan, a Man City fan, they also might be fans of the Huddersfield Giants, the Leeds Rhinos, or whatever it is. And they might just take their abuse around the various sports. But I found working in rugby a lot easier, probably because it doesn't have the popularity that football does. You know, you struggle to find, I imagine you would struggle to find a Leeds Rhinos fan or a Huddersfield Giants fan out in, you know, Kenya somewhere or over in, you know, America somewhere. But, you know, in football, there are fans from just all, and big fan groups from all over the world. And because of obviously that, with the time difference as well, you know, when fans in England stop giving you abuse, people from other side of the world have woken up and they start giving you abuse. So it really is just this never-ending loop of awfulness.
There's the positives of the global game right there. To bring in Tommy then, and a part of the reason I invited you on, because I know you're a very active user of social media in one way or another. So in terms of touching on what Ryan has talked about with sort of that bombardment of social media, sometimes abuse that you can get, but also, like you say, effectively learning the job on the job played out to a whole bunch of readers. How's that been for you?
So for me, like when I was at university, I actually worked as a chef at the same time. And anyone who knows anything about the hospitality and catering industry is that's another similar tough environment with a lot of strong personalities. So before I even got into journalism and started doing reporting and stuff like that, I was already finding that I was working every single day in an environment where I had to, in the nicest way, toughen up a little bit, and I had to be assured of myself and confident in my own thoughts and all that sort of thing. So when I actually came out of that job and I started doing freelance reporting stuff for West Ham, again, fortunately, my route into kind of reporting went via sort of the ladies team and the academy teams and the sort of side of football that I suppose is a little bit more niche and a little bit less in the mainstream news sort of thing. So I was starting to build followers within the football environment and things like that. But most of the conversations were nice. And when I was doing academy updates and things like that, the reaction was fairly positive most of the time. But yeah, I completely appreciate and agree with the fact that we all know that what football's like, and it just doesn't involve social media. It involves the reason why you can have a beer at rugby, for example, but you can't with football. And it seems to be that there's this whole pressure, I suppose, around football that does make it hard for journalists that are in that industry. But in terms of my actual dealings with social media, like, working for the past 4 years in local news as well, I mean, as I'm sure you appreciate as well, Alistair, is that we deal with some of the worst things that you could probably report on as a journalist anyway, and they're very emotional topics, and we have to take a stance of being professional. We have to be sensitive, not because that's our job, because we want to be as well, because we're reporting on other human beings and we appreciate how hard their lives have been and the situations they're going through. So when it obviously comes to social media, I think to a certain extent people feel like we're just these journalism robots that are kind of insensitive and just churning out stories and not really caring about the law or people's feelings and things like that. And as Ryan says, we're humans too. We're humans that are sitting behind a computer that are trying to do a professional job and also trying to deliver news, however sensitive the topic is, in the best way that we can, not just for the readers, but for the people that we're interviewing on. So when the comments do come in, I think sometimes the way that I look at it is there's a reason why I like reading comments. Comments are the things that can help us help other people and get feedback on our work. But then similarly, sometimes you're just going to meet some people that sit behind their computer and just want to be offensive just for the sake of being offensive. And fortunately, I've got myself into a mindset more recently over the last couple of years where I found that the comments that people would make are definitely different to what they would say if they saw me in the street. So for me, that's a little bit of a I suppose, a saving grace, that you kind of just know that if somebody has got the time in their life to sit there and just write offensive comments, then unfortunately that's them wasting their own time, sort of thing. If anyone wants to ever give me a constructive comment, however much it criticizes me, if it's constructive, I will sit there and I'll have a conversation with anyone for as long as possible. But the minute it starts getting offensive and unnecessary, that's when I just sit there and go, to be fair, it's gone too far and I'm not really interested anymore.
Do you think either the numbers of comments that are being submitted or the way people are commenting or the things people are saying, have you noticed a change in the work that you've been doing over the last year, given that people have had more time potentially to sit in front of a screen? Do you think that you look at the comments that you receive on social media now, compare that to December 2019, and have you seen a difference?
To be honest, I haven't really seen a massive difference, especially on again, as I'm sure Alistair will vouch for it, is that the sort of way that we work has always been the same for the past 3 years. And the only thing that has changed has the audience has got bigger. So I suppose in that way that we are getting more and more comments and comments coming from different avenues as we open up different platforms and things like that. But in terms of how offensive it is or how regular people do it, it's only ever going to be really in the situation that we've been in as the same amount, because we always put out the same amount of content, and a story might get 10 comments, it might get 100 comments depending on what the situation is. So for me, that's been the same kind of now and through the pandemic as it was beforehand.
My next question kind of follows on from that in terms of what we've seen change. And I suppose that the obvious difference is that we're all working in our rooms now and working at home. And newsrooms are very much a long and distant memory at the moment. For me anyway, it's a lot easier, I think, to deal with abusive comments if you've got friends in the newsroom that you can bounce that off of and have a bit of fun along the way. So coming to Ryan first on this particular topic, and working remotely, bearing in mind you also said that you only just moved before we started recording, only just moved to Derby 2 months before the pandemic actually got properly underway. How's it been in managing the remote working situation and the, I suppose, the sometimes isolation that can bring with it?
Well, even sort of when the world wasn't on fire, like our HQ was in London, and we've got writers scattered around all over the place. So I've always kind of worked remotely, but even that brought with it some challenges, because I'd never worked remotely. You know, I'd always gone to a place of work. So even, I guess it kind of does relate, because I've never done this before anyway. And now, you know, my new home was, places were all shut and closed off. So we didn't really have a choice but to really just stay here in my house, in my office. And yeah, kind of, I like to think I'm a creative person to try and bounce ideas, you know, around and off myself and can do that. But it's just, it's really mentally taxing when it's just you and your own thoughts. And like, you know, sometimes if you're having a day that sucks and you want to get out and you think, well, can't, because there's no place to just go. And in my instance, was like, and there's no one I know. So you're just kind of trapped in your own little madness, trying to drag and will yourself. And it has an effect on the quality of the work you produce, because you're not really fully engaged with it. You're just trying to get to the end of it so you can just tick it off a list and just try and ease yourself mentally. But even that, then you think, well, that's not really the quality of work I want to produce. So even that, you get wrapped up in it. And then, yeah, it's just, you know, you're essentially trying to punch a hurricane and just try and get this thing to go away, but it doesn't, and it won't. And yeah, when it's just you versus you in that office, trying to formulate ideas and write these ideas up, and you know, trying to just be the best journalist that you can be, but you have no one to kind of judge, to kind of help you along with that in person. Yeah, it's difficult. It's a challenge, particularly if, like me, you are a social butterfly where, you know, you enjoy being around other humans. I'm not particularly an introverted person.
Tommy, I imagine And we used to go to Sainsbury's every lunchtime. That's a long time in the past, but little things like that where you can sort of break off from, you know, the death and destruction that often happens in news. And like we've talked about before in private, it's different when you're by yourself in your room with just your screens as company.
Yeah, definitely. And the hardest thing, I think, about this whole coronavirus thing and the way the home working situation has come around is the fact that we both have come into this from not just a lively newsroom, but what has been told several times to us over the last couple of years has been one of the craziest, most enjoyable, fun, energetic newsrooms that people have ever been in. And to then just one day walk out of that and then all of a sudden have to try and set up on your kitchen table in your parents' house sort of thing. It is hard. And then during the pandemic, I then moved into rented accommodation with my fiance and sort of taking over a section of the lounge and spending all, you wake up in the morning, you sit at your desk, you're sort of doing your 10-hour shift writing news and, like Ryan said, trying to be creative, trying to come up with all this kind of imagination to give to the readers. And then at the end of the day, you finish off and you're meant to turn off your computer and just go and sit on the sofa that's about two steps away and try and relax. And I completely appreciate and understand that it's exactly what's needed to be done in the past year and a bit. And I understand exactly the benefits of it as well, like being able to not do the commute in the morning and all that sort of thing, save a bit of money on petrol. It's been really good. But I think for me, when we started working from home in March last year, although it seems strange, for quite a few months, I was so wrapped up in the new way of working that it didn't really hit me how I actually felt about being in a flat or wherever on my own all day. It was only as we got closer to like the winter months that it really like sort of, I was looking out and it was dark when I started work. It was dark when I finished work. I'm very active. I like to go out and do walking and stuff quite a lot. And during the summer, when you finish your shift and you go out and do a 2-hour walk in the sun, it's nice. And that's your chance to clear your head. But when it got to the winter and it was like, it was cold, it was wet, it was dreary, and you're finishing work and there's just nothing. And I think it was then that it really hit me that actually I missed the office more than I actually ever thought I did. Now, more recently, like my fiance was an incredible help, and she actually sat me down and she was like, you need to be making sure you're taking that hour lunch break. You need to, whatever the weather, still go out and have those walks, because Tom, walking is your thing. You enjoy doing it. So if it means going out for half an hour because it's really cold, then just do that. Don't do an hour. And ever since I've started doing that, I have found that working remotely has been much easier, because I've found those things that actually give me, whether it is the 20 minutes, half an hour or an hour away from the computer, where I can just go, right, I'm done, leave it, let me go and clear my head, I'll come back in half an hour, and then I'm actually ready to go again.
Working in journalism and comms isn't a 9-to-5 job. There's always something happening, there's always something to be on the lookout for. And I know for me personally, my work-life balance has always been terrible. Like, I've always worked more hours than I should. I've always, you know, been switched on, like checking work emails at weekends or outside of hours. And I think for me personally, that's got worse. And I've been putting a lot more pressure on myself, because that sort of work-life balance has now come into my home. I'm not sort of, because you're working from home and then you're sort of living at home, it's much more difficult to switch off for me personally. And I'm finding that quite draining. I just sort of wondered how you guys have found that. Have you found that it is more difficult to switch off and you are checking things more, or have you actually found it's had the opposite effects on you, and because you are sort of working from home, you've learned to actually appreciate being at home a bit more and not working?
For me, it hasn't really changed as much in terms of how much that I check my phone or how a certain story and stuff's doing. As I've already mentioned, it's hard to be in
as you say, live and work in the same sort of place. And it's nice to for some people to have like an office in the house and then have a living room or whatever, so you don't have to directly mix a living room with a dining a office with a dining room or an office and a lounge. If you have that the ability to have an office in your house or something, then I'd imagine that it would be a lot easier than like you say, taking over a massive part of like say your lounge or your kitchen. But yeah, for me, I've always been so engrossed in my work that I kind of find it hard to switch off. But before I started taking those regular walks and stuff, I was just finding myself in a sort of never-ending spiral of kind of work, and then sit on the sofa two steps away and checking the emails and things like that. Whereas now I've actually got myself into a mindset where, right, for whether it's at the end of the shift, if there's something important I have to do, of course I'm going to do it because I'm committed to my job. But I've had to kind of make that move to actually go, right, no, I can't keep doing this, otherwise my head will just go, right, I need to do it this way. I need to concentrate on having my break during the day to split the day up, and then at the end of the day, if I want to check something because I want to check it, I'll do it. If it's something important, I'll do it. But just generally, that's where the office stuff stays, and now it's work, now it's personal time.
I actually found it a little more difficult to get motivated working from home. Because I sometimes, you know, share a joke with Carl Anker, who's a good friend of mine who covers Manchester United for The Athletic, that we're in jail. that this is your little prison cell, you know, and you just have to, you know, try and go about your business as much as you possibly can. But the grind of sort of wake up, you know, go into my office, rattle around until lunch, go downstairs, kitchen, watch an hour of TV, back upstairs, rattle away until 6, 7, 8 o'clock, downstairs, watch some TV, work out, shower, bed. That on repeat for months really does feel like you are in jail. Like that really feels like a prisoner routine. And I found that after a while, I was like, this is just so unfulfilling. Like, you know, the nuts and bolts of journalism is finding stuff out, and you can do that from your phone. But you know, missing going out to meet people, meeting like, you know, contacts for a coffee, or missing actually doing interviews face to face, you know, where there's a lot more, you know, naturally human interaction at play, and also with interviews being face to face, comms officers aren't shackled by the time of 40-minute Zoom calls, so you can always push your luck a little bit more, and things like that were just all sucked away, you know, because of the situation we find ourselves in. So I actually found it a lot harder at times to motivate myself to even begin my work life balance, let alone maintain it. But I think setting boundaries is important. I tried for a couple of weeks trying to work from the sofa, so I was like, I could switch the TV on and have Sky Sports News in the background. There were even periods where I'd work from bed, you know, when I'm having a bad day, and I'd just think, you know what, I'm going to brush my teeth, grab a coffee, I'm getting back in bed with my laptop, and that's me for the day. I ain't moving until it's time to eat again at 6 in the evening. That became difficult because now suddenly I've turned my bed into my office space and I can't chill out. Even when it's bedtime, I have to got to get all these notepads out of the way and all that sort of stuff. So it was setting the boundaries was really, really important, and keeping to those boundaries as well. So, and that extends to the phone, because obviously you all just live in each other's phone right now. So my phone goes on do not disturb mode from 8 o'clock. Unless your family or one or two friends, you ain't hearing from me until 7:30 the next morning. And that was a hard and fast rule I had to set. Unless, such is the nature of sport, something absolutely mad happened that I had to deal with. But obviously that's always the exception to the rule. And then when I was, so for instance, tomorrow night, I'll be watching the Champions League. My phone will be upstairs on charge. And I had to learn to, like, you know what, sometimes it's okay to not put your thoughts on Twitter. Sometimes you can just watch and enjoy a football game and not have a say on it. You can have your own opinions and say them out loud to yourself. Stop yourself going mad. You don't have to put them on the timeline. You don't have to engage with the timeline. Put the phone upstairs and just leave it be and just enjoy watching this football game. And I had to set a lot of boundaries and almost boundaries within the boundaries to just try and manage the day as best as I could.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that in some way. Likewise, the motivation side, certainly for me anyway, like January, February, March was not a fun set of months. Much for what you just said, Ryan, like the monotony, just living the same day every single day. And for those who are watching this, like you can see my bed. It's not that far away from where I work. So the number of steps to get on shift, it's not that many. I suppose the change in the clocks and getting a bit more sunlight to play with, certainly from my perspective, has made a big difference, as well as muting WhatsApp. I've made that very much part of my weekend now. All those days during the week where I am off, because we have a very active WhatsApp group for both content editors and for just the general teams in general. And when your phone goes every 15, 20 minutes, the urge is there, isn't it? To look and see what's happening. Is that something I need to deal with? And so on. So actively shutting that down for a couple of days can definitely make a difference. And I'm just going to quickly drop in a website called Newsbreak, which I'm not sure if anyone on this call has heard of it yet, but it was set up by BBC journalist Tom Hourigan as a place for journalists to go and share their experiences of mental health in the pandemic, which I suppose to me maybe signals how we maybe as people in an industry are very guilty of pushing ourselves to the limit. Is that a fair thing to say? And like I said, we've all mentioned sort of regimes and things that we're forcing ourselves to do just to balance out our own mental health a little bit more. And I suppose in terms of advice, is that something that you would say to a young journalist who might be getting into a role for the very first time, is to set yourself those regimented breaks just to give yourself a little bit of a peace of mind?
I'd say so, for sure. Obviously speaking as still a relatively young journalist who's a little bit wet behind the ears on some stuff, I think one of the things that I found was, yeah, you know, journalists always push themselves to go way beyond what is considered a normal breaking point, because I think that is a byproduct of how competitive the industry is. And I think also it's a byproduct of how, I probably shouldn't say this about my own industry, but how petty our industry is and how insecure our industry is. I found that with, I think, a lot of journalists. You know, you beat some journalists to a story, they don't particularly like it, or, you know, you're covering the same patch and there's a little bit of tension and animosity there. That was something that was new to me, because I was like, some of you are grown ass men. Like, what are you doing? Like, what are we doing here? Like, you know, you can be over there doing your thing, I'm over here doing my thing. And, you know, if I get a story, then great. You probably get the next one. You've had like three or four, but there's always the drive for the next story, the next story, the next one, the next one. And that is relentless. And that will consume you. That will absolutely, because it's your bread and butter, right? That's your absolute bread and butter. But like, what I discovered was, whether I'm here or I'm not, stories get broke anyway. So, you know, and you're going to get some, and others you're not going to get. So I was like, so why am I killing myself out here doing this? So yeah, I'd say that to any young journalist is to, you know, don't get caught up in thinking next story, next story, next story. Got to get the next one. Got to beat that person to the scoop, or that person to the scoop. Because like, there is no really beating them. There's always going to be stories, like, and you're going to break, you know, you're going to break some of them. And for me as an experienced journalist, I was trying to butt heads with people that have done this for 20 years. I was like, this isn't a fair fight. Of course I can't compete. I don't have the contacts yet. Don't have the experience or the know-how yet. So it was like, yeah, like this pressure you're putting on yourself is ridiculous, because you don't have the skill set yet to try and take these guys on. It just wasn't fair. So at that point it was like, okay, don't push yourself hard, but don't push yourself to those kind of extremes.
I completely agree on that one as well. I think when you're just coming into the industry, I think there's certain things that you're going to have to learn to do with that kind of hamster wheel of how it works, because you've got to go through it to know how to deal with it. But I think that the difference is if you're coming into the industry, there's going to always be a fine line between being hungry and enthusiastic and want to get every story, because I think that sort of commitment and passion to the job is always good, but then it is also getting to the point where you understand that it's exactly what Ryan just said, you're not going to get every exclusive, you're not going to get every story, so you need to build up the contacts, you need to work, you need to build the experience, because like I say, there's always going to be stories that come along, and having that drive, passion, ambition, all that sort of stuff is good, and it, for a young journalist, it will put you in that position where you feel like you want to work every hour under the sun and get every single story. But eventually you need to just realize what you're actually up against and put yourself in the best position by building contacts and things like that. And eventually you'll be in a position where stories will come to you for you to break them, rather than you constantly doing the chasing on the hamster wheel.
I'm actually going to slightly roguely for us jump in with sort of my own experience as well. I know we normally used to be asking the questions, but I just want to say that in comms as well, like sports comms and in journalism and sports journalism, as alluded to earlier, it's not 9 to 5, and you're going to be working unsociable hours, you're going to be working long hours. And I remember we hosted the Women's World Cup in London in 2018, and I think I worked for 21 or 22 consecutive days, like 9 to 9 every day, and those opportunities are incredible, and I'd say like take them. But it's about then finding that balance and taking the time off like when you can, because you do accrue that time in leave or however your company works, that you can take it back. And that's one thing I've always been so bad at. And because I'd never really took that time back after the World Cup, but fortunately it was sort of less than a year into the job, I could sort of bounce back from 22 days straight quite quickly. But then I remember in 2019, it was the first year of the hockey's pro league competition, and we had loads of away fixtures and then we had loads of home fixtures. So you're working Monday to Friday and then you're working stupid hours on Saturday and Sunday. And I wasn't taking my annual leave. I wasn't taking my toil. And I got to the end of 2019 and Alistair and I were going up to visit our partners, the Mintridge Foundation. And we were going up the day before this sort of training day that we're having and staying overnight, and then we're going to be there. And I remember I was having to get the train to get to Peterborough, and I just felt really unwell, I felt really tired. And I remember the trains were cancelled, and like there was sort of still a way for me to like get another ticket and get a later train, and I just was like, I can't do this. And I remember just like getting on the head down, message dad, said I'm like, I'm sorry, trains have been an issue, I'm going to have to come, I'll come up tomorrow morning. I remember going home, like head down, not talking to anyone, just didn't do anything on the train. And I got back in and I literally went straight to bed and collapsed and slept for 2 hours, which is unlike me. I never sleep during the day. Next day I went up and I just remember I was shaking all day. I felt so unwell. I couldn't eat. I felt sick because I just burnt myself out. And working in sport is an incredible opportunity, and you do so many great things and you work so many amazing hours, but you've got to find ways of taking that time back and looking after yourself, because it will catch up with you eventually. No matter how many amazing opportunities you do, there will become a point where you do burn out if you're not looking after yourself. And I think for that would be my advice, is be strict with taking time back and make the most of the time off as well.
A lot of nodding heads there. I think it's fair to say is definitely make use of the time off when you do, and don't push yourself to the brink. And I think we've all probably been guilty in one way or another at various stages of doing that. We'll take a brief pause there because we're going to bring in Rebecca, who's obviously going to share her own experiences with mental health in the industry as well.
This podcast is a member of The Bear, internet radio and podcast network. Find more great podcasts at thebear.live.
Rebecca, thanks for lending your own voice to this particular podcast episode on mental health in the media and with social media. I've already covered a lot of things on the episode so far. With regards to Ryan and Tommy's own experiences, just to throw in sort of what you've experienced yourself, really, with regards to mental health, and I suppose specifically with maybe the abuse side of things, because I think as journalists, it's something we can all probably relate to in a way that some people who aren't in the public eye or in journalism can't really compare with. So from your own perspective, how has that been sort of managing both sides of it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I think my certainly my early experiences, and I suppose still the bulk of my experiences, are sort of this kind of just low harm of maybe you wouldn't even call it abuse, but just sort of no one cares about women's sport is how I sort of would sum it up. And I've had that really from, you know, I've been writing about women's sport for almost 6 years now, and the whole time, you know, even through sort of reader comments and just that sort of, like I said, this almost background noise of people saying that they sort of don't care, or, you know, the classic is sort of no one cares about women's football, and you think, well, you care enough to take time out of your day to reply to this tweet or whatever it might be. But so I get a lot of that, and I think it's quite interesting because it's very easy to brush it off, it's very easy to sort of laugh about it, but actually I think when you get that quite relentlessly, it can really grind you down. And certainly if you're not getting, so what I tend to find with certainly with things like reader comments or comments on Twitter, is the first comments tend to set the tone. So if you have early comments from people saying this is really interesting, I found this, you know, a fascinating subject, then that will set a tone of kind of people agreeing or saying, you know, I really liked this angle. Whereas if the first comments are no one cares about women's football, no one cares about women's sport, then it sort of emboldens everybody else to join in who is that way inclined. I have also had some of the nastier stuff. So I tend to find that within sort of speaking about women's sport or women's football, the sort of community are very obviously very supportive, and you tend to increasingly these days as well get quite a supportive response, whereas if I write about men's football, for example, that's probably the worst, or sometimes other men's sports, that's when you get a lot more hostile comments, a lot more of the sort of sense that you don't have the right to comment in that space. And I, you know, did once make the mistake of tweeting about Cristiano Ronaldo, which was definitely the most vitriolic and quite shocking abuse that I've ever had, and tipping it over into much more misogynistic and kind of sexualized comments. So yeah, that was quite upsetting, and I think the worst that I've had, but luckily I don't write about him very often. So yeah.
It's having spoken to Lindsay Hooper and Kate Borsay of Offside Rule Parish, obviously, for those who are in the know. And I suppose there's a lot of similar experiences there when they do venture into the men's football side of things. Was that a real wake-up call when you got that level of abuse?
Yeah, and I think it was a wake-up call as well, in the sense that I didn't know where to go. And I think because, so, you know, I'd been open before with, you know, with colleagues, with my editors, etc., about the kind of comments we were getting, particularly, you know, if they're from your own readers or within your own site, then you can have, your editor will often be aware of it, or you can have conversations about that. But I found when it came to my personal Twitter, and it was a lot more serious, I didn't really know where to turn or what to do. I didn't really know who to talk to. And that's, you know, the company, my company would always be amazingly supportive, but it was more just that you suddenly feel a bit sort of lost. And I know, you know, my mum was very adamant. She was like, you need to like report this and you need to take it very seriously. Actually, one of the most helpful things I found was talking to other female journalists. So saying, I've had this, have you had something similar? What did you do? And even just sharing those experiences makes you feel far less alone and far more able to sort of tackle what you're dealing with, I think.
We're talking a lot about sort of the, I suppose I don't want to call it the negatives, because obviously we're all passionate about this industry for various reasons. But as Ryan mentioned, it can be relentless at times. But then, like you say, there's that flip side where it's almost like that camaraderie and a bit like a community, I suppose, where you can support each other when you are going through things that we can all relate to, particularly with the abuse side of things. Is that very much a true reflection on sort of the people in it and how they'll stand up for each other when needed?
Yeah, absolutely. And what that, I think that would be what I'd say is one of the biggest early mistakes I made as a journalist, is that I didn't surround myself with enough other journalists. I didn't know the value of that support system in the way that I do now. And I think, you know, it is an odd job. and to an extent, only people who do it can understand it. I think there are parallels in other industries. And certainly, obviously, there are parallels between the kind of abuse that, for example, a female athlete might experience compared to a female journalist writing about female athletes. Sometimes it's the same comment, as I'm sure. But yeah, I think the support network is actually incredibly strong as long as you reach out to it, I suppose, and as long as you build it around you, it can be amazing.
Looking at yourself when you first kind of ventured into that territory, I suppose first steps in journalism to you now, what do you think is the biggest takeaway you've had or the biggest thing you've learned?
I think it is the support system. Certainly also just being honest. You know, I think you, when you're a young journalist, you're so keen to you know, be doing everything perfectly all the time and everything right and be the first to get all the stories and stuff, and you forget that it's quite normal to feel a bit of imposter syndrome. It's quite normal to feel you know, certainly with big stories, they can make you incredibly anxious. Getting a big story over the line, particularly if it's sensitive, if it's legally difficult, you know, if it's been a lot of work to get to that point, the sort of sheer adrenaline drop once you file a piece like that and come off the back of it, and then the sort of journey as it goes out into the world and it becomes received as a piece, can be hugely sort of draining for your mental health. And I think I felt in the early days that maybe I was the only one feeling like that because I was a young journalist. So maybe it was just because it was new. And actually, I don't think you lose that. You know, if you care about what you write about, you're always going to care about what you write about. And probably just realizing, you know, I wish in a sense I'd realized much sooner that everybody was going through things like this. Everybody has confidence dips. Everybody has sort of stress about stories, and just reaching out and being honest about how I was feeling. And hopefully, you know, you normally always get someone say, it's okay, I've been there too, or I feel like that too.
Following on from that, and it's something I can relate to a little bit because I look back at when I first took on my current role, leading the Hearts Live site, which launched the first day of us all working from home in the pandemic, which was a fun day for everyone involved.
God.
But I know. And I felt so compelled to do everything. Like work absolutely relentlessly just to make it work considering the circumstances, and it's taken a lot of time to actually tell yourself it's okay to take a step back every now and again. It's still going to go on like without you. You can afford yourself a little bit of time. And in terms of switching off, is that something you've experienced as well, whether it's, I know, sitting down watching telly in the evening and then suddenly you're thinking about that story that you've got going on in the background as well?
Yeah, it's not easy. And I don't know that I still have the right answer after however many years of trying. I think certainly, you know, I noticed this a lot at the beginning of the pandemic, working from home and just not really finding or finding, I suppose, that the key barriers that separate your working life, whether that's a commute, whether that's doing an interview, you know, outdoors or in someone's office or whatever that might be, obviously that's suddenly all in your home, and that's suddenly all something that you're dealing with, like, and then sort of spending that time in the same space with all that, you know, energy, hope you don't sound like someone from kind of LA, but you know what I mean, around you, and I wasn't doing very well at separating that. I think we all struggle with that, and as you said, just trying to do everything all the time. I also found, because, you know, you didn't really want to take any holiday because there was nowhere to go in the first pandemic, the first beginning of the pandemic.
Staycation to your living room. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, it's not a good sell, is it? But then I, you know, it worked out after a few months that I'd had sort of 6 months of working with absolutely no time off, apart from obviously standard weekend time off. I hadn't had a proper break, and that is really, really not good for you. So I think you just have to be quite strict. And I'm very lucky. I am a staff journalist. Obviously, if you're freelance, that's even harder to carve out that time for yourself, to take time off, to take holidays, etc. But sometimes I think you can only learn the hard way. And when you don't do that, you can burn out very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. How have you found the working from home situation? Because I think it's probably varied for a lot of people in that, yes, there's the plus point of not having the commute in terms of money, saving time and all that. But then, like you say, everything is in one room right now.
Yeah, I have found it quite difficult. I think obviously initially it was just the sheer shock. You know, I went from traveling so much, you know, up to Liverpool, Manchester, wherever that might be. I once did sort of Cornwall in a day, like for stories, that was completely normal, to then obviously just being stuck in my own house, I was due to be at the Olympics for best part of 2 months, and obviously that was taken away from me. So once the initial sort of shock had sort of ended, I think I then just struggled with that separation that I mentioned. So I spent a lot of last year doing interviews about abuse allegations in gymnastics, and my desk is in my bedroom. I would do those interviews, often be working through till very late at night to get these stories over the line. And then you're basically sort of walking from your desk to your bed, getting up again in the morning and starting all over again. And that is a very unhealthy thing to do. It's very bad for you, I think, you know, especially, but not exclusively, but especially when stories are very upsetting, very difficult, when you're dealing with upsetting stories, to have all that in your own home, I think is a real downside of the pandemic. Obviously, I think that will change as we get back into offices. But also, as a reporter, you know, I don't go into the office every day. I often work from home, or did before the pandemic. So it's just about learning how to separate that. You know, I started to take some calls in the kitchen, just simple things like that, so it wasn't all in one space. Or, you know, just making sure at the end of the day that you pack all your work things up in a sort of visible way, or take a walk or something just to take your mind off things. So it hasn't been an easy transition, absolutely.
How is it now? Have you kind of struck a better balance with things like that?
I think so, she says. I do think so. I think also you have to be very strict, you know, just because you are. So normally in pre-pandemic times, the main time I'd be working from home is on my deadline days, when I have a lot of writing to get done. And if it's once a week, you can kind of get away with being a bit sort of unhealthy about it, in the sense that you just spend all day at your desk, get it all done, finish late and just go to bed and stop thinking about it. Whereas, you know, actually when that's every single day, you have to be stricter. So, you know, I try and go for walks as much as possible, even if it's literally around the block, just to clear my head, yoga, things like that. I've ordered a standing desk, which physiotherapist told me to get. So, you know, I think we're getting there, but it's learning about yourself as well and what works for you.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the big things of all of this, isn't it? We've probably all learned so much more about ourselves than we probably ever would have if we'd gone through a similar period. And Tommy very much said a similar thing, in that it took his fiance to tell him that, you know, you used to like going for walks, force yourself to take like a 15-20 minute walk just so you can see something else rather than your screen through that day. Are we good at managing ourselves as journalists? Because that is a very big question, but something we touched on, in that there's such a drive in, like, most of the people I meet in the industry anyway, to do good, but to always look at the next thing once you've filed that, you know, story, that as relentless as it can be in terms of workload, your mind's already onto the next one and then the next one, rather than sort of taking stock of things a little bit more. Not sure if that's fair to say about the industry.
I think we're better. I think certainly if I look back at previous generations and in conversations with my colleagues and stuff, I think there was a much... there was definitely not an open conversation around mental health as much. It was very much expected that you'd kind of burn the candle at both ends. I know that sort of, you know, hard drinking was a big thing, but, you know, you hear all these sort of myths and legends. And a lot of people said to me when I joined the business, oh, you've missed the good old days. You know, this isn't as fun as it used to be. But I think quite seriously, there was far less of an atmosphere in which you could say, you know, I'm feeling quite burnt out, or I've worked really hard on this, or I'm struggling, or my confidence is low, whatever that might be. That has come in partly, I think, with the younger generation of journalists, and partly, I think, with just the way that the industry is changing, and obviously how the whole world is having a better conversation about mental health. I still don't think, I think the job doesn't lend itself to sort of superb mental health at all times. I think obviously that can depend on a great editor or a great workplace. And, you know, I'm very lucky. My workplace is increasingly working on mental health strategies, or being really open about it, which is great. But as a job, obviously, you are kind of at the mercy of the news cycle, at the mercy of some like slightly odd hours. You know, I've worked weekends for the best part of 6 years, and that is just the job. So I think you have to have a degree of flexibility when you go into it, to know that the hours are going to be quite long, quite unpredictable. Sometimes there's quite a lot of time away. I've spent sort of 5 weeks abroad for a World Cup before, and that's very challenging on your friends and family. You know, I don't have kids, but I know it's very, very hard to be away from your kids for that long. So there are elements of the job that will always probably be there, but there are also ways of handling that and conversations you can have with your editors where you say, look, I'm worried about this, or I'm working on this, and it's been really hard for me. Certainly I know I was working for another organization probably about 7 or 8 years ago now, and I was offered counseling as part of a really difficult story, which is brilliant. And I think that's happening much more, that journalists feel that they don't have to shoulder, you know, you don't have to hear all these difficult stories, take on this really difficult subject, and then just sit with it. There's now support in place that maybe there wasn't as much before.
One thing I hadn't really thought of that you just mentioned there about spending, 5 weeks at a time away covering, be it a World Cup or possibly the Olympics, who knows?
Touch wood.
Yeah, touch wood. That is, how do you kind of get to grips with that when you're spending that amount of time away, presumably in like a hotel room as well? Because that is, like you say, a big adjustment for quite a significant part of the year.
Yeah, it's not easy. And I've not done loads. I've done sort of 2 major stints abroad for tournaments and things. And so I'm still kind of a novice in that area. But I will say it's not a natural, healthy working environment. Obviously, for a start, you're probably operating on a different time zone to your desk. So that time was in France, but I have done the Commonwealth Games, which were in Australia, which meant you'd done a whole day of work by the time your editors woke up and then wanted other stories. So by its very nature, you're going to be, your sleep patterns will be disrupted, you'll be sleeping a lot less probably. You know, like you said, hotel rooms, I hate hotels. So one of the things that I did when I was in France for the Women's World Cup was that I mostly used Airbnbs, which I think actually, you know, is the policy around that is ever changing. And we're generally speaking, you often have to use the hotels that are associated with the accredited press, because that's sort of the safest and best option. But there was much more flexibility in France. And so, yeah, I used Airbnbs. And I know, for example, I need vegetables, which sounds so sad. And I promise I was having a beer in the bar after a big deadline with everyone else and being fun. But I knew I couldn't do 5 weeks on hotel food or restaurant food. You know, there were a couple of evenings when I would just stay in and cook a, you know, a big thing of pasta or broccoli or whatever it might be. And that really kept me sane. I think also, again, just coming back to that support network, the colleagues I had around me out there were incredible. And it was such an open environment where people could say, you know, I've had a really tough day, or I haven't slept properly tonight, and I'm, you know, this deadline's really, really looming, and this match is going to be really stressful, whatever it might be, just being honest around each other. And then, of course, there's the great side of it too, which is that it is a bit work hard, play hard. Of course, you go out for dinner all together and have a bottle of wine or whatever. But it's interesting because you learn so much about what you need on those trips. And sometimes it is just broccoli.
There's nothing wrong with a broccoli and a beer combined.
Exactly, you can go hand in hand.
That's also just reminded me of, specifically from the Women's World Cup, Sophie Lawson's Airbnb that I think she had, which if anyone saw that on Twitter, that was an experience in itself. You didn't have to be
a cautionary tale.
Yeah, a cautionary tale of what can happen when you book Airbnbs. Mental Health Awareness Week is hosted by the Mental Health Foundation. You can find more information and support it at www.mentalhealth.org.uk. Social media. We'll kind of touch on this more specifically. Obviously, it's something we're all involved with in various ways. It's got its positives. It's got its negatives. How would you say it's impacted your own individual lives, maybe away from the professional side of things? Because we so often get bogged down in the toxicity side of things, don't we? But it is easy to forget that there are the positives, particularly when we're all living in a virtual world right now.
Yeah, I think social media always will have positives, because it finally connected the entire world together. It exposed all of humankind's flaws there for us all to see. But you know, of course, it has its positives. I've been able to, I chat with quite a few people about their mental health, and because you know I've been really open about mine on the timeline, I've spoke to quite a few people in the DMs about their experiences, and you know, and we've shared things, and you know, if you can just try and help one person feel okay, then that's an awesome thing that you're doing. I think that's wonderful. I'll be honest with you. I'll be really honest with you. I don't really have that much positive to say about social media anymore at all, because for you know every one wonderful thing that happened, and look, you know, we can look at what Marcus Rashford did over the course of lockdown, trying to help feed you know children in underprivileged areas and all that sort of stuff. You know, footballers giving shirts away to fans and you know all that kind of thing. People who have lost loved ones over the pandemic, and you know, clubs or players or whoever it is have helped them with signed shirts for charities or whatever it is. That's all absolutely wonderful, and we should absolutely highlight that an awful lot more. My problem is too many footballers have their accounts managed by agents or PR agencies, I always think football clubs generally are terrified of being anything other than incredibly vanilla and boring, which just creates this sort of vacuum of personality, which makes it difficult to like and engage with, and I don't like it. And I've become that because it's easier. I understand why they do it. Don't get me wrong. I understand why they do it because I've had to start doing that as well, because for me it's easier. I find it hard to really find that much positive to say about any social media.
To quickly butt in as well, because I know you mentioned before about not being on Facebook anymore. Was that part of the thought process in that maybe you didn't feel compelled anymore that you had to be on social media? Because I feel that can sometimes be something that's expected of people now, that you have to be on social media.
Yeah, so particularly after September when I had to go away for 3 weeks after I walked out the game, for me it was about managing my digital footprint better, because I realized I was just hooked to my phone. I'd close Twitter, I'd open up Instagram, I'd close Instagram, I'd open up Snapchat, I'd close that, and I'd open up Facebook, and I was just like not, and before you know it, like 3 hours have passed, and what have you achieved? You know, what have you enjoyed? What has happened? You just think nothing. I'm just 3 hours closer to the grave. So I got rid of Facebook. I toyed with getting rid of Facebook for a very long time, but it was difficult. Like, it was admittedly difficult, because I was like, I'd been on Facebook since I was about 16. So there was 12 years of me being on there, building this little profile, and all my friends were on there and all that stuff. And to just be like, I'm putting that in the bin now. But then I quickly realized, well, all my actual friends that I still like, you know, I still have the phone numbers of, and I still talk to, and yeah, I was just kind of like, yeah, just don't need it anymore. I don't use it anymore. I don't enjoy it anymore. Obviously, Facebook has some very problematic ethical issues. Every social media company does. But it was in my power to think, well, I'm not using you anymore. Then I put it in the bin. Same with Snapchat, went in the bin. And Instagram, I used to have a public Instagram profile. And then when it was like, oh, wait, you're getting more Twitter followers, and they're now looping through to your Instagram profile, I was like, I'm not quite sure I'm comfortable with these amount of strangers having a window into what my life is like. So I made that Instagram, private. I think I controlled my digital output a lot more and became a lot more aware about just protecting myself mentally, you know, because when my Instagram profile was public, there were people from Twitter who I blocked that found my Instagram profile and then abused me. And I was like, right, okay, now we are going to fight, because this is my space now, buddy. Like, this is my space. You don't get to come in here at all and speak to me like that. So me and you, we're going to have a fight in here. But then the problem was, you know, that gets screenshotted and put on forums. Look at how he's talking to us and this, that, and the other. And you think, you know what? I can't win. I can't win. So, the little things like that were kind of like, I had to just protect myself a little bit.
And Tommy, because again, I know you're quite active on social media, but again, it's finding that balance, I suppose, that works, isn't it?
Yeah, I've always had quite a big interest in social media. Obviously, that's why my career has sort of gone the way that it has. And I think I completely agree, though, because I feel like years ago, I would have probably just had all the different social medias because it was the thing that everyone was doing. And you feel like everything you have to put out and you have to display every single piece of your life in public for people to judge, for people to like, for people to give their opinion on. And I think Ryan's completely right, is where I think more recently being in this role and being in a job where, I mean, my job is to engage with people via social media because I want people to engage with the company's pages and stuff that I help to run, sort of thing. So I have to be one of those people that has to sit there and try and engage with a social media audience, which could be really nice one day. It could be a little bit more hostile the next day, sort of thing. So I think being in that sort of industry every single day, it does teach you when it comes to your personal life and you just go, do I need to put that out? Like, what will that add to me? Like, for example, if I go around for a walk and I take a nice picture, okay, that is a positive thing that will probably get positive comments and might put a smile on somebody else's face. Like Ryan said about if you can have a conversation with somebody and you help one person with their mental health, it's a good thing to do. But it is very important to actually sit there and go, will this benefit me in one way or another, or will it benefit somebody else and not cause me problems? Because if it causes me problems and I'm just going to open myself up for people to come at me in all directions with negative responses, then what is the point? Why are we doing that? And I think that's the important thing. And I think that's what people kind of get caught up in. It's going along with the social media train towards the destination that nobody wants to go in, because we all feel like we have to get on and that's the way that we have to go. Whereas sometimes you have to actually sit there and go, well, if it doesn't benefit me, then why am I going to do that? I need to protect myself, and I'm not just going to put my whole life out on social media for people to criticize, because like, what's the point? What is the point of that? Social media should be a place where all the platforms should be putting more effort into protect people and to go back to what it kind of was initially intended to be, this nice place for people to interact with each other and show each other's videos and pictures and stuff, because we can't all live, especially in a pandemic, we can't meet up and see people. So this is all we've had. But then obviously, as with everything in this world, you're going to get some people that want to use it for a negative reason and they want to just come at you, and you have to be prepared for that, and you have to think two steps ahead to think, if there's them sort of people out there, I need to do what I need to do, and if it means that I restrict what about my life I put out there, then so be it.
I think so. Social media replaced genuine self-esteem, right? As you touched on, Tommy, you suddenly were in this artificial world where everything was measured by likes and comments, and you know, you get that little feedback loop in your head, those little that little bit of dopamine hits when, ooh, you know, 20 likes on this photo, ooh, 10 comments, 50 retweets, you go viral, man, you're on cloud nine. And that replaced genuine self-esteem. But you think, but it's all it don't mean nothing. Like, it means what? You look at, you know, social media, it's, you allow people to see what you want them to see, right? And often that's the very best of us. And it means nothing. You look at photos that have got all these filters on them now, and, you know, the way things are framed, and the rise of influencer culture and all those things, it's not real. And that's why I had to like start unplugging, because I was like, none of this is real. I'm measuring my self-esteem against things that don't exist. They're not real. It's all artificial. It's rubbish. It's nonsense. You know, there, and I've been part of that. I had to look at my mirror and was like, I'm part of that. There were times when I was on Twitter, when I was bringing all positivity and energy and isn't this great and isn't this amazing, and I was f-ing miserable, because that's really what I felt, but I couldn't put that out there, you know, because that was too much feelings. And also I think it could be misconstrued as maybe attention seeking, but there were times when I was miserable, but was still acting like I was happy. you know, and using social media in a, you know, in accordance to being happy, pretending to be happy. And it replaced genuine self, you know, my genuine self-esteem, because if a tweet didn't get X amount of likes, I was like, well, I thought it banged. I thought it was funny. Why does no one else think it's funny? If a photo didn't get X amount of likes or, you know, whatever it was like, oh, I don't understand it. And it eventually just became, I have to become happy with myself. If I think it's cool, then I don't really care what any of you think. And I think that more withdrawn, private, just way of living massively helped me. You know, I didn't have to start putting everything on the timeline or on Instagram or anything like that, because it was like, well, if I enjoy it, it is absolutely nobody else's business. I try as much as I can, and I still don't get it right all the time. Don't get me wrong. I haven't gone completely in the other direction, but I'm much more even keeled, where I think, listen, if I think this is cool, then I'm the only person that needs to think it's cool. I don't care what anyone else thinks. And then I stopped sharing as much, because I was like, I don't need this artificial approval no more. For one of the things for me as well, to kind of bring it back to working in sport and stuff like that, is, you know, I went through a phase of when I was a very heavy Twitter user, where, you know, I remember one always sticks out, you know, sometimes it isn't bad comments at all. You know, sometimes it's just people, you know, being people on Twitter and want to be all up in your business because you're a journalist and it's your job to know stuff and fans want to know stuff. But I remember I was watching the Great British Bake Off, right? And I'm tweeting about the Great British Bake Off. And one fan underneath went, Ryan, any news on who we're bringing in the summer? And I'm like, you know, will you just off? Like, and, you know, this person wasn't being mean or nasty. I'm like, it's 9 o'clock. I'm trying to watch the Bake Off. I do not care who you're bringing in this summer right now. I don't care. Go away. Leave me alone. This is my time now. This is my time. I don't care about Derby County right now. I care about who's winning this Showstopper. That's what I care about right now. But it's relentless, right? Because football is a relentless industry. And I had to learn. And look, I'm not digging this one person out. It's just the one that always sticks out. Because I remember reading, was like, man, I really can't get away, can I? So yeah, that was one time where I was like, if you don't have to share it, then just don't. Then just don't. Because there'll always be one football fan that, you know, you're just tweeting about, you know, a movie you've seen. Or, you know, you could be tweeting about a different sport or whatever it is you're tweeting about. Someone will be like, what's going on with so-and-so? What's happening with this? Ryan, are we staying up? What's going on with here? What's doing this? What's happening here? And you're just like, oh, can you just leave me alone for an hour? And then eventually think, you know what? I'll take the power. I'll log out for an hour instead. I'll log out and I'll disappear. And then no one can chip in with whatever. I'll just sit here and enjoy my TV show. And now no one will ever get to know what Showstopper I thought was great. But I think, but does anyone really care about that? And you just think, no. So it's just me and my own enjoyment.
It's interesting you say that. I just think a lot of it is, it's not necessarily ignorance, but you know that the older adage of think before you speak probably should be amended to like think before you tweet, because a lot of the things that people say are so ignorant and they're not actually thinking. I remember we had an incident at work a few months ago. So we've been on part-time furlough for a few months, and then our men's team were playing some games and we didn't cover them because they were practice games, they were on cap, they were unofficial, and also we couldn't cover them. And then this Indian journalist puts out this tweet and accuses Great Britain Hockey of like not caring. And like, he had absolutely no idea why we weren't reporting on the games. He's like, are you just not reporting on your teams? You clearly don't care about hockey and all these sorts of things. And that riles me. And it's obviously that ignorance of people on social media, like they're just not thinking before they're tweeting, and therefore people are saying things that they're probably going to regret.
Again, I'm going to bring in Rebecca just to tell us about what she has seen rather on social media herself as a reporter in sport as well.
So I do keep my I have very much sort of work social media accounts and personal accounts, and I think that is really important. So for example, I have Instagram, but I've never used it for work purposes, and I don't sort of wish to. It's for photos of my family, and it's interesting because I have been encouraged to, you know, it's a really powerful platform and great for your profile and things, but I have never really felt comfortable doing that. That's just me, but I think that has helped. In terms of Twitter, you know, social media has been a massive positive in my career in many ways. You know, Certainly when I was a very like much younger journalist and trying to sort of make a name for myself or trying to get my work out there, there often is no other sort of way. There's no one else is going to promote your work for you, basically. And it was amazing. And I was finding, you know, great interaction. Obviously you can follow senior journalists, see what they're up to. Certainly a lot of my early radio work was coming through Twitter. If I'd tweeted that I'd written about something or had some insight into a subject, then like producers will get in touch with you. And that was fantastic for my career. Obviously then I think you see the other side of it. As we've mentioned, the sort of abuse or even just, I think constant feedback can be quite overwhelming. It's, you know, Twitter is less bad at this than Instagram, for example, but obviously there is a culture of, you know, sort of show and tell your best bits and the best things that have happened to you in your awards or your achievements. And very few people are on there saying, I'm struggling with a story or I'm having a really tough time, obviously, because, you know, why would you post that? But some people do now. And I think the pandemic has changed that a bit, is that people are more willing to post saying, I'm in a real rut or I'm feeling rubbish. Or we've seen a lot recently around this New York Times piece about languishing, about how everyone's kind of stuck in this sort of limbo. And I think people are more open than they were, but it can be quite easy to get into this sort of comparative culture where you feel like, well, I'm not getting as big a byline as they are. I'm not getting enough stories out, whatever that might be. So it's a real blessing and a curse, definitely.
Yeah, like it's a double-edged sword, if it's the perfect example of that. One phrase I took out from Ryan's comments on it, and he was very much of the view that social media replaced self-esteem. And whether it's too much to say that, yeah, it's a big sentence, like you say. But I suppose it ties into the failure side of things. I'm not posting about the failure, like you say, because it's so natural just to rank yourself in comparison to what you see others post, or how many likes one of your posts has versus how many likes someone else has. And I say that's always struck me as something to be cautious about anyway, because I think it's so easy to fall into that trap, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's quite important to, just from a journalistic perspective, preserve sort of your pride in your stories as just that. So, you know, if you produce a story that you're really, you know, you cared a lot about, or you feel really proud of the journalism that went into it and the outcome, and the piece you've written, whatever that might be, I think it's very important to remind yourself of that, because social media is quite fickle. It's quite odd. Obviously, you don't really know how the algorithms are working. And there's no guarantee that just because you really cared about a piece and you think you've done a brilliant job, it's going to be retweeted hundreds of times and everyone's going to love it. So I think you have to really preserve that sense of your own work without, you know, before you post it. Because if you do post it and you don't get that initial reaction, and I've had it where pieces I'm really proud of just haven't, for whatever reason, like not done well, but they haven't kind of garnered much interest on social media. And I think you have to come back to yourself and say, was I proud of the work I did there? Yes. Okay. You know, park it. That's all that matters.
Having sat through an hour-long meeting on Facebook algorithms this morning, I can completely understand that. Like I say, it's...
Tell us what they're doing. Tell us what you know.
Oh, God, who knows? And the feedback we get, and there's a lot of times just arms in the air going, okay, we'll work with what we've got. Kind of my final point then, or a very broad final point. What advice would you give to anyone working in the media that's helped you out specifically, or at least helped you get to where you are in being able to manage these things a bit better?
Talk to people. I think it's two strands, you know, find a network if you can. And I think don't underestimate the importance of colleagues and other people in the industry, because they will have a very particular lens on it all. They will understand what you're going through. But also, you know, talk to your loved ones, talk to your friends, talk to your family, explain, you know, don't just sort of file something and stress about it. Explain why it's stressing you out, explain what you're going through. The worst thing you can do, I think, is sit there and think it's just me and I'm the only one feeling like this, because you're absolutely not. And you'll find that everyone will be happy to help you out and talk about it.
Absolutely. And I name checked it earlier in the episode, but was it Newsbreak, I think, is a website that's been set up for mental health, or for a place for journalists to go and discuss mental health. And I think something like that shows exactly what you said, and that you are not alone, and that there's plenty of other people going through the same thing. So having that open conversation can certainly do the world of good. thank you so much, Rebecca, for coming on.
No problem.
And sharing your own perspective. Like I said, I think my favourite part of putting this whole episode together is, as well as acknowledging how tough it can be, but it's also the advice that's been put out there, and how you can structure yourself, your days, to make those things a little bit better. Because I think we've all probably been guilty, particularly over the winter months, in my case, of slipping into a monotonous pattern. But clocks have changed, sun's back out, sort of. So you can help, you can structure your days a little bit better and have a bit more of a break. So thank you so much for sharing that. You're listening to Sportspiel's Mental Health Awareness Week podcast specials. Go to our website or follow us on social media to catch all 5 episodes throughout the week and help raise awareness using the hashtag Mental Health Awareness Week. You can find all those links and resources in the show notes of this podcast episode. My kind of final questions for the pair of you while we have you. Over the last, you know, 2-3 years, however far back you want to go, what are the main lessons you have picked up in terms of managing your social media use, but also looking after yourselves at the same time?
I'll let Ryan go first on this one.
I think
for me, it was, I think for me being new, it was realizing that I had to change how I interacted with social media. You know, when you're just Ryan Conway, 20-something-year-old, you know, glass collector at some pub, no one really cares about your opinion. When you're Ryan Conway, Derby County correspondent for The Athletic, a lot of people care about your opinion. A lot of people are relying on you as well to provide them with accurate information. That brings with it an incredible amount of pressure. And the more of your life that you show on there, because remember, if you've always just been used to just tweeting random nonsense, and suddenly you're merging into this different thing, you have to be comfortable enough that some people will tell you, this is rubbish, that's rubbish, why do you do this, that's crap. Ryan, who's signing for who when you're trying to watch Bake Off and all that stuff. For me, my advice would be change your relationship with social media. Some of you might say, well, I shouldn't have to. Well, you shouldn't have to do a lot of things. But unfortunately, this is a, you know, absolutely relentless space. And you're going to have to learn to adapt and change how you interact with it if you want to stay, in my opinion, sane. And just don't put too much stock in it. LeBron James said, at the end of the day, it's just Twitter.
I completely agree with that as well. I think the one piece of advice or lesson that I would say is exactly the same, is you have to be comfortable in yourself and your own thoughts. And I always say, if you're a nice person and somebody doesn't like that, then that's their problem. Like, you can only be a nice person and you can only do what you think is right. And you do have to be clever with how you deal with social media to avoid being swept away, whether that is changing how much you put out or how much you engage, and having to bite your lip when somebody writes a comment that you really, really just want to kind of get on your keyboard and start an argument back. And sometimes, like Ryan says, you've just got to bite your lip and you've just got to think, right, if I don't control myself, I can't control how somebody engages with me on social media. The only thing that I can do is I can control what I do on there. And as long as I put out things that I know are going to benefit me, and then I engage positively with people, if people want to come at me or whatever, then sometimes I'll look at it to see if there's any sort of constructive criticism in there. If it's just vile abuse, unfortunately, it disappears from my screen straight away, and I just avoid it because it's not going to benefit me. So it's just, yeah, my piece of advice would just be confident in yourself, be assured of yourself, but then also sometimes you have to make exceptions and you might just have to bite your lip and you've got to be clever with it. Otherwise you will just get swept away with it, and it's so easy to get swept away. You see the amount of people that struggle to deal with social media. It's so easy and it's so hard to fight against, but you are in control ultimately. You can turn your laptop off, you can switch your phone off, and you are in this world with people around you that probably want to talk to you and engage with you, sort of thing. You don't need this digital world. Use the digital world if it benefits you, but if it doesn't benefit you and it's starting to make you feel upset or emotional or anything like that, take a step back, go back to basics, go back to human interaction, go and talk to someone, phone your mum up, phone your friend up, whatever it is, and just go back to basics, because it's a crazy world.
It's a crazy world indeed. I think we wholeheartedly endorse that, Will, don't we?
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying about biting your lip, and I think you guys might agree, but the more you work in social media and the more you work, you learn to disassociate between the comments that are genuine questions and the comments where someone, or the questions where someone is asking to spoil for a fight. And it's about the getting that experience to know what is a genuine question that someone wants an actual answer to, and is someone who is just looking for a fight and biting your lip and not responding to them, because that's what they want you to do. Don't give them that satisfaction. Take the moral high ground.
And goes into a lot of the emails I receive these days as well. I can tell the genuine complaints, but I can also tell the ones who are just trying to give me a bad day, which there's quite a few. On top of what you guys have said very wisely, I'll throw in burnout into that as well. And if you do ever find yourself pushing yourself to the brink, take a step back again, because as Ryan said, news continues, even if you are in it, or if you happen to have a day off, it will still keep getting told. So you don't have to put your responsibility or that level of responsibility on your shoulders. With that then, I'll bring an end to this particular episode. And I have to say, everyone, I think that's one of our more open chats that we've ever had on the show. We've had quite a few in-depth discussions about mental health with a variety of different guests, but I thank everyone on this call for being as open as they have been with regards to their own experiences, what they've seen on a day-to-day basis. But also, I think the advice given is also something very, very practical for a lot of people to take away if they do find themselves in a similar situation. So thanks everyone for that. My final pointer is, of course, this is our second Mental Health Awareness Week podcast episode that we're putting out. For the Awareness Week, it is run by the Mental Health Foundation, so if you can support it, please do. Likewise, if you do need to find any charities or any supporting help, there's a list of contacts in the show notes of this episode, so you can find that there. With that then, thank you, Ryan, for coming onto the show. Absolute pleasure to hear your own story, and fingers crossed for Derby for the rest of the season. It's going to be touch and go. Thank you, Tommy, for coming on. I know I'm seeing you on Friday and Saturday, but hey-ho, the power of podcasting. And of course, thank you to Will, as ever. Take care, everyone. Look after yourselves. The world is still a little bit mad at the moment, but it will improve. And you will hear from us next time.